ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Alicia Simmons.
And I'm Lee Boucher.
As historians, we've spent years digging into the lives of people who've changed history, for better or for worse.
So naturally, we are extremely qualified to gossip about them.
And because they're dead, they can't sue.
In our podcast, we sift through Australia's most notable and notorious characters, giving you our unfiltered takes.
Search the Dead Can't Sue podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has told the nation it's not a matter of if or even when AI will transform the economy, but rather a question of how. So how might the government's new AI framework allow us to be more than just a data warehouse? And according to a recent study from the Australian Council of Superannuation Investors, the average ASX 100 CEO earned 55 times more than the average wage earner during the last financial year. And what does it mean for the Australian economy that half of the highest earners in ASX-listed companies are based in the US? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Daniel Ziffer.
And I'm ABC News Business Editor Michael Yander.
And Mike, just before we get into AI chat, are you real?
Yes, I am here, present in Ultimo, although we're not sitting in the same room, so...
We're not, and the best thing I like, there was a convincing pause at the start where you had to think about it, so that's good. AI couldn't do that, it would respond too quickly. Now, Mike, we've just finished listening to the Prime Minister's speech broadcast from the University of Sydney announcing a national framework for AI. Not often that a PM quotes the Pope in a discussion about technology, but that's the potential scale of the impact of AI. Now, what are your initial impressions?
Look, I think if you put in an AI prompt to write me a speech in a folksy and friendly but reassuringly prime ministerial tone about how the government was going to handle the challenges of artificial intelligence, you could have come up with something quite similar to what Anthony Albanese delivered today. It certainly was heavy on the folksiness and anecdotes, personal anecdotes. I loved the one about his first job at the Commonwealth Bank and convincing people to switch from passbooks to key cards and use this scary new technology called an ATM, and likening that to the kind of technological revolutions and then some that we're confronting. But in terms of actual detail about what the government's going to do, I mean, really all we got was what we knew we were going to get, which is this new office of AI sitting within Albo's office, within Prime Minister and Cabinet, and working with the industry portfolios, Tim Ayres and Andrew Charlton. But we didn't get a lot of detail.
So they want to coordinate the design of Australian standards for AI. Pretty difficult to do when this is global tech racing at a furious pace. Now, he said in the speech he wants to not view AI as a threat to jobs, but as a way to make good ones. Was there anything that you took out of it that seeks to give an Australian flavour to what is otherwise a kind of global race that seems to have very few rules around it?
I mean, I think the key takeout I got from what Anthony Albanese was saying today was that we need a national coordinated strategy, because if we approach AI, and this is paraphrasing basically the conclusion of his speech, if we approach AI as a group of disparate states, local governments, corporations, individuals, we're going to get steamrolled by massive global corporations that are driving this technology. Now, even with a national approach, Australia is not a massive country, and we may still get steamrolled by massive global corporations, some of which are valued roughly around the same level as our annual economic output. But I guess his argument is we stand a better chance if we are pulling in the same direction and have a consistent set of rules and goals than if we just let the market be, laissez-faire approach, as they say in economics.
So instead of the let it rip, he wants to see cooperation with states and territories on a couple of these key things. So this is expectations around data centres, copyright protection for the inputs, the stuff that goes into making AI so smart, and the impact of AI on workers. So large AI data centres will be discussed in a meeting next month. They've been one of the key flashpoints because they're one of the very physical, tangible impacts that we're seeing from AI. Do you think that that's been the biggest flashpoint so far because it's something that we can get our head around, that there is these massive hulking warehouses, use a lot of water, use a lot of energy, and pushing up the cost for those, situated in places we can actually see, whereas the rest of AI is quite ethereal to get around as a concept.
Yeah, I recall seeing media coverage the other week of some new big data center proposals about, you know, 1 or 2 km from where I grew up in the lower north shore of Sydney. And, you know, the local residents rising up in opposition to that. So I think you're right that we're seeing that as the tangible physical manifestation of artificial intelligence currently. I think the bigger issue going forward is going to be the effects on employment and the distribution of value from the supposed productivity gains, which we're sort of yet to see, but are promised from this new artificial intelligence technology, which not only affects workers, but potentially, as our colleague Alan Kohler, and also co-host of this podcast, pointed out in an excellent column on Monday, a lot of companies are turning around and wondering whether AI is about to steal all their lunch, not only a large chunk of their profits, but also a large chunk of their confidential proprietary data that drives those profits, and whether AI might use that data to set up rival banks, rival legal services firms, accounting services, you name it.
Really interesting thing happened here. A statement released Monday, US time, signed by over 200 economists and tech leaders, Nobel Prize winners, essentially warning about AI. Basically, their message was that increasingly capable systems could reshape the economy at immense speed. How much impact does it have when you have such eminent people getting together to sound what is really like the ringing of a bell, a warning about the unchecked way that we're heading forward?
It should cause an impact. It has gained some attention. To give you an idea of the names on this list, they are people like Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winning economist, Paul Krugman. We've got Olivia Blanchard, who used to be the IMF's chief economist, Neil Ferguson, from Stanford University, Ben Bernanke, the former head of the US Federal Reserve and now at the Brookings Institution, Geeta Gopinath, Betsy Stevenson, also formerly of the Fed, Justin Wolfers, Australian expat over in the US at the University of Michigan. And aside from these eminent economists, we've also got people like Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, Jack Clark, one of the co-founders of Anthropic, and the chief economist both from Anthropic and OpenAI. So even people developing this AI technology warning that we need to think about the ramifications. And it is a serious warning because the dislocation that could be caused if this does displace millions, tens or maybe, you know, tens of millions of white-collar information workers in the developed economies in a short space of time, and they warn that this could happen within a decade as opposed to some of the other industrial changes that happened over decades. We are talking about a big change within people's working lifetimes, potentially making swathes of jobs obsolete. And they say we have to be preparing for this before it starts happening, not once the jobs start going.
So I guess the Australian government's attempt today to set up an office to try and put a string lasso around the elephant that is heading off is, I guess, a start to try and achieve some of the gains, try and get some of the gains here. That dislocation potential is really real. You know, this is much faster than, as they discuss, the Industrial Revolution. This is happening really quickly, and it is happening through a handful of companies that are developing this technology that is, you know, really wreaking havoc to the models. It is keeping a lot of people up at night. When you see statements like this, when you see the potential for what it can do, what do you think are the chances that Australia is going to be able to harness this positively for business, for industry, for workers, rather than have it happen to us?
Again, going back to Alan Kohler's column on Monday, I thought his analogy was excellent of this being something like a cage fight between the US and China for global superpower dominance in artificial intelligence technology. and the rest of the world are not only spectators, but we're spectators sitting within the cage and hoping that we don't get hurt as collateral damage, but with little control over the two protagonists. And I think, you know, obviously Anthony Albanese today has, and the tone of the speech was very much about telling people, look, we're on top of this, we're conscious of it, we're doing stuff, but how much can Australia do to influence what's happening in the United States? And it's not just what's happening in Washington, it's principally what's happening in Silicon Valley. And when you've got a laissez-faire approach to regulating these big corporate giants, or in the case of China and Beijing, perhaps a state-directed approach to utilizing the technology for that country's particular ends, where does it leave a middle power like Australia? We've got some influence over the US, but as we've seen over recent years, particularly under the Trump administrations, you know, with great limits. We might be a friend, but, you know, that friendship doesn't necessarily buy you much in Washington.
The more you dig into AI, the pace of it is just what's so astonishing. You talk to companies and their long-term goals and forecasts and strategy are 18 months. You know, we're talking in pace of weeks and months with developments. And whilst we have the big names that we know, like Anthropic and others, there are still companies cropping up, particularly from China, that have very little public knowledge behind them, that are just appearing with models and technology that are supremely powerful. It's evolving so quickly that it makes me really glad we're doing a daily podcast.
Yeah, although it is crunching up against those physical realities of the fact that you need somewhere to house all this data, and those facilities have to be built. They need water and immense amounts of energy to run. And I think that could be, maybe the handbrake on just how fast this AI revolution can unfold.
Well, to circle back to data centers, which is what we talked about, the physical manifestation. In recent days, New York State has paused any more data center development for a year. They are starting to conflict with local and state governments here in Australia about different desires, or the desire to not have more data center development. That is going to become not a handbrake, but a pretty significant throttling, because we are scaling out so quickly. This is such a substantial part of our GDP. You know, our economy would not be growing if we removed the data center build out, but it is coming up against those very tangible, very physical limitations of space, water, and energy.
Yeah, and people. And yeah, when it comes down to it, what's an economy without people? Because what is the economy for if not to benefit people through a better standard of living?
Let's move on. A really fascinating report from ACSI, the Australian Council of Superannuation Investors. Now, it shows that Australia's highest paid executive doesn't live here and earns 500 times that of the average full-time worker. Now, our colleague Nasif Khadem has a great piece out this morning. You can read on the ABC website. I know, Mike, you've had a read of the report. There's a lot to unpack. Let's just start off. What is this report? What does it look at?
Yeah, so it looks at the ASX 200 CEO pay packets, basically, and it does it looking at their realised earnings. So not just the fixed pay, not just what the companies are reporting in their annual reports to shareholders, which are mandated for certainly for the Australian domiciled companies, and we'll come back to the difference between that and overseas based but Australian listed companies later. Now, they've managed to compile data for 80 of the ASX top 100 CEOs, 68 of the next 100 to 200 ASX listed companies by size, and 15 CEOs of companies that are part of the ASX but are domiciled elsewhere, that is headquartered legally elsewhere and don't have to report under the Australian Executive Pay Disclosure Framework.
So the ASX 200 is an index that tracks the value of our 200 largest listed companies. This looks at basically most of them. There's a few missing, but it really is a data set that goes to the bosses.
And it's been going for 25 years.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It is worth noting that this is basically the benchmark report into Australian executive pay.
So The average realised pay for an ASX 100 CEO went up, by my calculations, about 4.7% last year. It's just over $6 million. That's 55 times more than the average wage earner in the financial year 2025. What's happening to the people who are even beyond that? This is the average for the CEOs. Where's the top people landing?
Yeah, well, the top ranking was for Chris Hulls, who's a co-founder and executive chair of Life360, and his total realised pay for the last financial year came in at almost $48 million Australian dollars. Now, he's one of those heads of a US domiciled company that happens to be listed in Australia. Life360 is really a Silicon Valley giant, basically family kind of data sharing tracking app that's become quite popular. And the two behind him are both also US domiciled companies. So Mick Farrell from biotech company ResMed, which does, breathing devices.
Medical devices.
Yep. And then you've got Robert Thompson from a well-known company called News Corporation, once Australian, but now very firmly domiciled in the United States. And they came in at $35 million and $33.5 million respectively. And you have to go down to number four on the list before you get to the CEO of a company that's actually domiciled in Australia. And that was Vikesh Ramsunder from Sigma Healthcare, who's a realised pay clocked in at just under $33 million. But that is a bit of a special circumstance.
Yes.
Because they had a huge merger with Chemist Warehouse, and that share options basically that vested under that and were realised massively bumped up his pay to that level. So if you really want to go to the top local person on the list without special circumstances, it is once again Shemara Wickramanayake, the head of Macquarie Group, who came in at just over $30 million in realised pay. And she is usually up near the top of the list, as were her predecessors at Macquarie. They don't call it the millionaire's factory for nothing.
Now, the top three, five of the top 10, the highest earners are from essentially US-based companies. What does it mean for the Australian economy that so many of our biggest companies are essentially looking global to make that money?
Well, it actually says more about the structure of executive pay and the relative success in Australia of putting a lid on chief executive and executive pay packets versus, say, the United States, where these have always been very high and continue to run out of control. And that's certainly how ACSI, the Australian Council of Superannuation Investors, has framed it, which is that we've actually seen the fixed pay and even the realised pay of Australian chief executives pretty much stagnate, certainly relative to inflation, since a peak year, 15 years ago. There was a really big year of fixed pay. And since then, the level of fixed pay has actually declined, and more of Australian executives' pay is now linked to some kind of performance payment through bonuses and share incentives, which is what investors tend to want to see.
Reward for results.
Yeah, whereas in the US, I mean, a lot of that massive pay packet is also still linked to share incentives and so on, but at a far greater scale than what we're seeing locally. So, as noted, they don't have the same mandated executive pay disclosure requirements that we've now had in Australia for some time. And ACSI's argument is that transparency and pressure from groups like it and Ownership Matters, which was behind writing this report, and other shareholder advisory groups, is really keeping a lid and putting pressure on boards to keep a lid on how much their executives are paid. Although they're still earning 55 times what the average person does.
Now, you touched on bonuses. Obviously, that is contested. These are elements of compensation that must be achieved, and sometimes the hoops are easy to jump through and sometimes they are harder. What's going on with them, and what concerns does that raise for shareholders?
Yeah, look, the scary thing with the bonuses is just how easy it appears to be to achieve them. It's not like you need exceptional performance to achieve most of your bonus. there are basically very few years in which, well, there are no years in the recent years of the study in which CEOs have achieved less than 60% of the maximum bonuses they would have been entitled to other than financial year 2020, which was the first year of COVID and, of course, had the massive drop off in economic activity due to lockdowns and so on. But pretty much for the 11 years it's been tracking it, the Axis study has shown that CEOs get between 60 and 77% of the maximum bonus that they would be entitled to. Last financial year, it was nearly 71%. In fact, one chief executive from Mesoblast, Silviu Itescu, was awarded 120% of the maximum in consideration of, quote, product launch results that were beyond what was considered possible. So there you go. Even when you set a maximum, sometimes you can get more.
Well, the research again found that if you're the CEO of an ASX 100 company, you're more likely to lose your job than your bonus.
Exactly. There were more. I think it was twice as many CEOs who departed their positions as there were who didn't get a bonus.
Mike, to wrap up, you're the boss of the ABC business unit. Has this given you pause about perhaps how restrictive your long and short-term incentives are?
What long and short-term incentives, Dan? I work paycheck to paycheck just like you.
Well, if we're lucky, you'll get Christmas off this year.
Oh, yeah. We'll see. I have to say, I did get a good break last year, but the trade-off for that was having a baby. Yeah, so, you know, it wasn't really what you'd call a holiday.
It's a joy. It's not a holiday.
No, that's right. But, yeah, for a lot of chief executives, I mean, it does, you know, Axie's key point behind this report is probably still too easy to achieve these hurdles, or there just really aren't very high hurdles to getting bonus paid. So you get rewarded for doing a pretty average job. They did note, to be fair, that some of the executives with the very highest pay packets and some of the biggest bonus payouts were leading companies that had recorded particularly strong results and growth. So the bonus system does work. But again, the perennial question is how much of this corporate performance is actually down to the CEO and how much is down to factors well outside their control. And as we saw with that one exception for the COVID year where a lot of executives missed their bonus, I mean, what could most of those executives have done about COVID-19? It just happened to them.
That's it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to send us in a question, email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. That's abcbusinessdaily, all one word, @abc.net.au. Mike, catch you later.
See you, Dan.